coronavirus is, unfortunately, a fact of life now. While some insecurity in these challenging times is inevitable, many of us are becoming hijacked with symptoms of anxiety, panic, depression. It's hard sometimes not to feel out of control, frightened, desperate. So you have a choice that you can succumb to the excessive worry and fear that's gripping our nation. And in fact, though, you have a choice. Rather than passively allowing insecurity to cannibalize your healthy thinking with chronic what-ifs, we can learn to separate facts from fictions and release ourselves from toxic emotions. Bottom line, we are all capable of becoming active participants in our own empowerment and well-being. My guest today is Dr. Joe Luciani. He has been a practicing clinical psychologist for more than 40 years. He is the internationally best-selling author of a series of books published in 10 languages, and his latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is Unlearning Anxiety and Depression, the four-step self-coaching program to reclaiming your life. Dr. Joe, it's nice to have you on the program today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Okay, so your book is called Unlearning Anxiety and Depression. You could have had any number of different titles to that book. Why this one?
Well, I felt it was important to point out if something is to be unlearned, we almost more automatically assume it was learned. And this is how I approach anxiety and depression, how we learn to become anxious or depressed.
Okay. Now, associated with this book, you have a four-step self-coaching program to reclaim your life and work past this. Can you briefly summarize what that four-step coaching program is like?
Sure. The first step is a very critical step. It's learning to separate facts from emotional fictions. And quickly, the way you do that is you need to kind of imagine that you're a court stenographer. You don't want to get involved with the thoughts. You want to just observe them neutrally in a depersonalized way. So once you begin and understand the technique of separating facts from emotional fictions, it puts you at a place of choice. You can either allow insecurity to dominate, or you can take the steering wheel and choose to reject and move toward the truth that you see in front of you. The second step is we stop the insecurity-driven thinking. You know, those are the ruminative thoughts that swirl around. You know, we're on that hamster wheel of just what if, and rumination. So the different techniques there, I have an ABC technique for just cognitively stopping that train, active ignoring, which is training your brain to actually turn away from the noise of insecurity, and envisioning. So there are various techniques in step two for stopping those ruminative thoughts from just taking over our lives. And the third step is called responsive living, and it's learning to let life unfold rather than anticipating it with worrisome anxieties and just prognostications of doom and gloom. So it's learning to live more in the present, allowing life to unfold. And, of course, this requires a bit of self-trust. So this is certainly the central theme of my book, Developing Self-Trust. And the fourth step has to do with motivation. As a psychologist, I know that you really need to stay in the game. You need to keep someone motivated to do what they need to do on a daily basis. Retraining your brain, unlearning anxiety and depression requires practice. You need a format. You need to know what you got to do each day, and you need to practice it.
And you call this your mind talk technique, right?
I do, yes.
And so how did you come on to this term, mind talk?
Well, essentially, it's important to separate ourselves or to think of insecurity as occurring within our mind, but it tends to get a life of its own. Insecurity, if left unchecked, will dominate a healthy mind or eclipse a healthy mind, and that's when we become anxious or depressed. And that happens when we become, I call it passive thinking, when we become passive to our insecurities and we allow this reflexive insecurity to have its way with us. So we need to develop active mind. An active mind is using the focus of consciousness to really intervene in that knee-jerk reactive stuff from the unconscious, that the stuff that really creates kind of just reflexive reacting with worry, with just anticipation, with anxiety. So active mind versus passive mind, and the term mind talk was really, we need to learn a new language for talking to our own mind.
I see. Now, in your program, you highlighted in your book, of course, are people able to just use the book to be able to go through your program, or do they need a psychologist such as yourself to do that?
The book was written primarily for someone that does not need to be in therapy or doesn't want to be or can't be. It's a contained self-help program. It lays the foundation of understanding. And by the way, psychology, and once you understand the dynamics of what's going on, it's not rocket science. It makes common sense. I started out with traditional Freudian and Jungian analysis, and it was wonderful, and it was enlightening, and it was illuminating, but it didn't really solve problems. It was too abstract. It was too arcane. So I needed to develop something that was hands-on, and this led to wanting to put it down in a written form where people could guide themselves through practice and having a format such as Mind Talk to actually accomplishing this. And I feel I've been able to do that. I've had a lot of success worldwide. People email me all the time. But certainly the program itself is a hands-on. It's self-explanatory. It's really common sense once you understand the dynamics. So, yes, it is a program that you can use with a therapist if you're in therapy, or you can use it as a self-guided format for your own healing.
Back many years ago when I was a family practice doctor, my number one chief complaint was anxiety, and my number two was depression. I don't think that has changed too much in the years that have transpired. People are absolutely anxious, and they're absolutely depressed. Now, I see that as an addictionologist as a symptom of the broader disease of addiction with its 30-something different behaviors. And I find that when people get rid of their disease of addiction, the anxiety and depression lets up considerably, if not completely. What do you think about anxiety and depression from your point of view?
Well, I think we're rather close in views. I do perceive anxiety and depression, the undercurrent, or that which really is able to nurture and nourish anxiety and depression, is compulsivity. And as I'm sure you might agree, compulsivity and addiction are kind of synonymous terms. And what I see, though, is that we become compulsive with our worrying, with our behaviors. These behaviors could certainly fall into addictive categories. But what happens is that, again, we have now been compromised by our brain that has now been trained towards these tendencies of compulsivity, of addiction. And we are passive to this process, and as long as we remain passive, then of course we inadvertently fuel and feed these habits. And I know it sounds heretical, but I do treat anxiety and depression as habits of insecurity, and that's where the compulsivity arises from. We're just trying to feel safe. So when you start out with a core of insecurity, you're feeling vulnerable. So what do human beings do when they feel vulnerable? They do anything they can to feel less vulnerable. And that's where we tend to really start to try to manipulate and control life. And controlling life is really like a juggler. Eventually, it becomes like lactic acid, and eventually that control juggle begins to falter. We become desperate. That's where anxiety and depression come in. And it's from the depletion. Trying to control life is a very stressful thing. Just ask anyone that's a worrywart. Stress depletes chemistry. And when we deplete chemistry, we are functioning at an imbalanced state, which is why medication works. So in order to stop the imbalance, we must stop that which is really depleting us, and that's the chronic insecurity-driven compulsions and behaviors and thoughts.
You talk about insecurity. I think I put it in terms of low self-esteem. I think we're probably talking about the same thing, but low self-esteem, in my view, is the cause of every addictive behavior. And if somehow you can increase your self-esteem, then you don't need the addictive behavior. So I'm coming from the point of view of being able to try to do that. And sometimes there's 20-something symptoms of the disease, that including anxiety and depression, that sort of melt away when the disease goes away. Do you have some self-coaching tips to help unlearn anxiety and depression, right? And I'm looking at your media kit, and you said you must differentiate fact from emotional fiction. What do you mean by that?
Well, emotional fictions are the reactions to our vulnerability. And this is when you feel. So, for example, feelings are not necessarily facts. So when you say, I feel I'm going to have a bad day, or I feel I'm going to get fired, when you treat that as a fact, you're actually putting yourself in a sympathetic nervous system position where your body's going to react with the stress chemicals. And we're now putting ourselves in a stressful situation based not on factual reality, because the future hasn't occurred, but on the fictional assumption that I might get fired and other situations like that. In the case of this virus, it might be that I'm going to catch this virus. So when you allow your mind to anticipate in order to try to feel safer and less vulnerable, what you're actually doing is you're putting your physiology in a state of readiness and protectiveness based on the fictions. So this depletion occurs all the time if the mind doesn't differentiate between saber-toothed tiger and the imagined tiger. Our physiology doesn't differentiate. So when we imagine danger in safe places, we are affecting our chemistry. We are training ourselves to remain insecure, and we're really feeding our anxieties and depressions. So differentiating facts from those fictions is so critical, because I've never really worked with anyone with anxiety or depression that hasn't had a problem with the distortion of those two. Seeing fictions as facts and treating them as facts underlines, you know, or take for example an anxious person, look at their anxieties. They're never in the present. It's always about the what if, what if, what if, what's coming around that corner. So if you live in the future trying to be safe in the present, it's really almost an oxymoron. You're not in danger, you're imagining danger. So we put ourselves in these scenarios where we're actually creating a kind of chemical chaos, both mentally and physically.
When the average person watches television and they're exposed to the media 24 hours a day, every day, telling them this, that, and the other is the fact, and then later saying, well, that's not the fact, we've learned something different, they're on a merry-go-round of things that are fictional, but they're being told to us is fact. And so people stay in a high state of anxiety, right?
They do.
How do you or any person deal with the fact that there's really no way of knowing what's fact and fiction?
Mm-hmm. Well, typically, and let's just say that typically, whenever you anticipate something in the future, something that hasn't happened, then in a sense, that's not a verifiable fact. It's an anticipation of something that may be or may not be. So it's you're dealing with probabilities. The insecure, worrisome person, of course, has a very low threshold and will see most terrible, negative things, pessimistic things as facts. But you're absolutely correct that, you know, we are fed facts, quote unquote, from various sources. And there is a distinction between normal anxiety and neurotic anxiety. A soldier in combat is going to have a certain degree of what we might call circumstantial anxiety. This is understandable. We can see that as being normal for the circumstances. And with this virus, there is a certain amount of understandable anxiety, which would not be labeled neurotic. The neurotic component comes in when we take facts and add to those facts our insecurity projections. So now we take fact A and we treat it as doom and gloom, fact B. So we've now kind of gone from, we've extrapolated from a fact that is somewhat threatening, but now we've made it catastrophe. So, you know, it is a matter of letting insecurity just have its way with the interpretations we make of our world.
Well, I like your second point, and that is to turn off or limit your TV and social media viewing. Those two things are driving people crazy.
They certainly are. The person that is susceptible to anxiety and depression is more vulnerable and more susceptible because they're already starting out from a place of insecurity, of vulnerability. When you watch a constant stream of catastrophizing, which our media now likes to imbibe in, there's no way you could not be feeding those thoughts. The more susceptible you are, the more likely you are to feed those thoughts, which lead to anxiety, depression. So the important thing is, if you are suffering now, if you really have sustained anxiety or depression, limiting your exposure is one way to quiet down the stimuli that are keeping you constantly on edge and feeding the problem that exists for you.
I read somewhere that there's no real reason to worry about things because 90% of what you're worrying about will never happen. And the other 10%, you can't do anything about it anyway. So if that's your belief system, maybe that could quiet your anxiety down to a certain extent.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, I remember Mark Twain, he said just about the same thing. I've worried about many things in my life, most of which have never happened.
Right.
And so we do live in a world where probabilities do matter. You wear a seatbelt to be safe. That's normal constructive control. You take vitamins to stay healthy. That's normal constructive behavior. So there is a difference between normal control and obsessive control. And obsessive control, of course, is where the compulsivity comes in. And once we get down to trying to compulsively control life, that's where we start to really develop, you know, the kind of imbalances that lead to all these struggles.
Your third point, which is extremely important, I think. I've done programs with other people on this, telling how to do it. But you need to think about your breathing when you're anxious. And you said, take a deep breath or two. Go on and expound on that a little bit.
Yeah, see, when we are in a hyper state, when we are anxious, we are in the sympathetic nervous system. That's the fight-flight reaction that we have. And it's an alert kind of physiology that's taking place. But there's a price to pay for that, of course. You know, cortisol, adrenaline, you know, it's just surging through the body, creating havoc. So taking deep breaths is one way to really do it. Well, it does a few things. One, it distracts your mind. You're focusing on your breath. You're oxygenating your body. You're going from that kind of hyperventilated state to a more relaxed state. You're switching from sympathetic to parasympathetic, which is the relaxing response of the body. And essentially, that deep breath is really just can be used as a focus and almost a mantra, if you will, to focus your mind away from the thoughts that are disturbing. By focusing on the breath, and it takes, like everything else, it takes some practice. The mind likes to wander. It likes to drift. But a deep breath is what I call belly breathing, putting your hand on your belly and feeling that diaphragm push the belly out as you inhale, and then feeling the belly go in as you exhale. These are distractive things that are all aligned with getting you to switch over to the relaxing parasympathetic response that will begin to calm you down. If you do nothing, if you allow your breathing to become more intense, if you start to become hyperventilated, if you start to allow the adrenaline to just psych you up, of course, then of course you suffer the consequences. Taking charge, realizing that you can take charge and interrupt the body's tendencies, you really do put yourself in the driver's seat instead of being victimized as we are in so many ways by life.
I remember many years ago with people who were in a panic state from anxiety, I would ask them to breathe into a paper bag, and that would increase their CO2 and slow their breathing rate down and help them get over their anxiety. I suppose that's still effective.
I would imagine so. I think that, you know, like that, belly breathing, meditation, but there are many ways to really calm down. Just an infinite way, really. I mean, exercise is perhaps one of the best. Just get your body moving, get the breath going, go for a jog, go for a walk. Once we start to realize that we need to do something rather than be passive to our own anxieties. Once we start to get into that action mode that we're in charge, and passive mind just is not acceptable. We need to take active control, healthy control, over our destiny.
Right. The next point was ground your thinking. Would you explain that?
Well, thinking run wild is chaotic thinking, and it's hysterical thinking. Thinking that is allowed to just run wild becomes catastrophizing, where everything becomes doom and gloom and pessimism rules. I always point out to my patients that neither optimism nor pessimism is something that can be proven, because we're dealing with the probabilities of the future. But I think everyone will agree that the optimist lives a much better life in the present. So there's a real payoff for risking being optimistic. And it's a risk, of course. People, the more insecure you are, the more risky it feels. But if you live your life as if it's going to be okay, you will have a much better here and now experience today. So it is worth cultivating and learning to take that leap of faith and trusting. The core of my self-coaching books has always been self-trust. The more we self-trust, the more we believe we'll handle what's coming around the corner. We are instinctual machines. Our whole anatomy is based on evolution's process of making us adapted to danger and handling our lives. We've handled thousands of challenges in our lives. What makes us think we won't handle the next one? So we are formidable survival machines, and we need to let go and trust that we will handle what's coming. The insecure, anxious, depressed person, they don't feel trust. So what they do is they compensate by worrying, by getting anxious, by avoiding. So these are all compensatory behaviors and addictions, as you might get into. Is addictive behavior is trying to step out of handling life and more or less excusing ourselves. This is is why addictive behavior becomes so compulsive, because then our muscle to handle life atrophies, and the less able we are to handle life, the more we rely on the addictive substance. Food can be addictive. Various foods, behaviors can be addictive. Gambling, for example. Things that try to excuse us from handling life will be reinforced by anxiety and depression, and the more that happens, the more our capacity to handle life atrophies.
Your fifth point, which goes back to something you've said previously, is stay present.
Yeah, it's you know, with this whole mindfulness movement, there is no better therapy than to learn to be present. Now, I don't care if you're a monk on the Himalayas sitting on a mountain meditating. No one's going to live 24/7 in the present. Our minds just aren't equipped for that. We do anticipate, and it's a protective aspect of our psyche. But the more you train yourself to be present, anxiety and depression can't exist in the present. Anxiety is not about what's going on right now. It's about the projections of insecurity. The more present you are, the more you are handling your life moment to moment, the more relaxed you're going to be and the more formidable you're going to be. This is predicated on the nature of self-trust. The more you are capable of trusting your resourcefulness, the more you can be present and not have to anticipate what's coming around that corner. So again, being present, Eckhart Tolle does a wonderful job with this in The Power of Now, his book. But he really has laid out, and I think quite a nice read on just the power of the now, the present. So being present is a very formidable therapeutic technique.
The Zen saying, chop wood, carry water. That's being in the present, right?
Absolutely.
Do whatever it is that you normally do and don't pay attention to something in your past or something that might happen in the future.
Yeah, chop wood, carry water. It's such a beautiful expression. It's all as simple as that. You know, we complicate everything in this day and age, and yet it all comes down to chop wood, carry water. Focus on what you're doing. If you're washing a dish, wash the dish. Don't be thinking about what you're doing tomorrow. The more you be present, the more you focus on chopping the wood, carrying the water, the simpler life becomes, the more understandable it becomes.
Absolutely. And your final point, challenge your thoughts.
Thoughts perpetrated by insecurity will be distortions. They are based on a historical attempt to try to be less vulnerable, and they are really habits that have ensued in order to protect you. Now, oftentimes, just in our developmental history, we've become insecure for various reasons. You mentioned earlier self-esteem and things like that. We've been somewhat corrupted by the challenges of our lives. No one has a perfect life, perfect parents. Everyone has lost separations, illnesses. So we develop these insecurities, and these insecurities will dominate, and it will force us to try to compensate. So the more you differentiate between the here and now truth versus the historical fictions, I always use a term called the child reflex. If you listen to panicky thoughts, if you listen to depressive thoughts, if you really pay attention, they sound childlike. Oh, I can't do this. It's too hard. I'll never make it. I'm going to get that virus. The thing is that they sound childish because the foundation for these hysteroid insecure thoughts were laid down in your past many years ago, and they do have this childish tinge to it. The mature adult thinking is quite different.
Why don't you take a minute to tell our audience, one, where they can get a copy of this really good book, and two, about your website, and do you have a podcast or not?
I do not,
okay.
Unfortunately.
So Tell them about your website then.
Yeah, my website is www.selfcoaching.net, N-E-T. And on the website, I have various videos and lectures I've given, articles I've written. I do a daily blog, so I would encourage anyone that's interested in my self-coaching philosophy to check into the blog section. And there are various different aspects of the website I think that you'd find instrumental and helpful in general. The book can be gotten, of course, from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the major booksellers. It's both in Kindle and in book form. So that's just been released a couple of weeks ago, and we're hoping for people to have a little word-of-mouth kind of marketing.
Right, right. Well, as far as my contact information, you can go to my podcast, and it's www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com, spelling Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And you can tell your friends and neighbors to go over there and listen to Dr. Luciani's program. The YouTube video, you would search under Wynn Henderson, M.D. And if you want to go over to the website, it's www.revwynhendersonmd.com. So you can get in touch with me any of those ways. And Joe, it's been nice having you on the program today. I hope they'll go out there and get a copy of your book or go over to your website and check you out more. And it's been great.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.